Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestall. North America is a land rich in history and folklore, and in his latest book, Legends, Myths, Monsters and Ghosts, author and researcher George Lunsford takes us from the tip of Alaska to the Mexican heartlands and everywhere in between. George and I also discuss some of his experiences hunting for Bigfoot and the Dogman, and much, much more after the break. But before that, of course, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. And you can also click the link in the show notes. And thank you to each and every one of you that support the show with your contributions. It is always greatly appreciated. Mysteries and Monsters is across most social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news and episodes, and our exclusive merchandise is available through TeePublic, and the link for those is in the show notes too. Our intro and outro music are performed by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you as always to Dean Bestall for his wonderful artwork, and the show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. Legends, first-hand experiences, and cryptids await with George Lunsford. The North American continent is a vast expanse that is full of strange history and folklore. A lifelong fascination with the unusual has led author George Lunsford on a journey of discovery into the strange across the continent. In his most recent book, Legends, Myths and Monsters and Ghosts, North American edition, takes us on a search for all manner of Fortean experiences. George, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate that.
Thank you for fitting me in, sir. Thank you for fitting me in. It looks a beautiful day in North Carolina.
Well, it's kind of rainy, but it's good, though. We need the rain.
So. Yes, well, I think summer's decided to turn up 2 months early here, George. It's absolutely glorious and has been for the last week. So I don't know what's going on here in the UK.
That's great.
Oh, yeah. We're not complaining for once about the weather. Makes a change.
Oh, Lordy.
So as I said in the introduction, George, you've had a lifelong sort of interest and connection with this, both through personal experience and personal interest. So obviously you had a situation as a young man when your grandmother passed and she came to visit you, which has happened to thousands of people around the world, George. Even in my own family, I've had relatives who had visitations from passed on members of the family in certain occasions, and often you get that sort of conversation about why were they visited and not me. But thankfully, it's not that bad a situation in my personal family. But I do know, in speaking with other researchers, it is sometimes a bone of contention for people. So were you interested in it prior to that, George, or was that sort of the catalyst that began your journey into all manner of weirdness?
Well, I've always been kind of weird anyway. So, you know, that was probably what got me into it in the back of my mind. But before that happened, there was a movie come out called The Legend of Boggy Creek. That's what really got me started. And I started reading books about Bigfoot. And of course, if you start with any of that stuff, it all leads back into ghosts and Bigfoot and UFOs and everything else. So you can't really study one without hitting everything throughout that, you know. And when my great grandmother passed away and she visited me to tell me bye, that was I never told anybody for the longest period of time. Because I still, for a long time, I thought it was just a dream and I could smell her perfume, but I still thought it was just in my head.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's, I think sometimes when you see something like that, George, and there's no sort of residual aroma or perfume around it, it's easy to sort of dismiss it as a dream or a fantasy or wish fulfillment, really. But I think the power of smell, I think in all aspects of our lives, can transform you somewhere else. And when it's a specific perfume, usually you associate it with a particular person.
Oh, yeah, definitely. That's one of your strongest senses is your smell. Mm. I mean, even if you walk down the road and you smell certain smells, it'll make you think of something that's happened. Like, you're going to smell like, say, Old Spice. It makes you think of your grandfather or your father. You know, stuff like that. It's just a weird thing that your body does. And your body and your brain is always trying to say, okay, this is what it is, whether it knows it is or not. It tries to associate it with something known opposite of something unknown. So you got to get your mind to working where you say, okay, no, you're wrong. This is what it was.
So I would imagine then, George, as a young man, you became a voracious reader and lover of these particular subjects. When did you make the leap from being really interested into this to sort of going, I'm going to start having a look around? Were you one of those people that started on your doorstep and sort of spread your wings as your experience and knowledge has developed? Or did you just go, right, I'm going to fly to British Columbia and see what I can find?
No, I'm one of these weird people that things just happened. You know, my first UFO I seen when I was over in the Navy. I was going across the Atlantic. And we seen it off the side of the ship, over the water, about 8 miles away from the ship. And I was watching it, and for some reason, my mind kept telling me, though, that can't be a UFO. So first thing I went to was the con tower for a submarine. That's what it looked like. It looked kind of round like. But the only difference was I got to look at it as it moved. It wasn't touching the water. It was like it was searching for something, but it wasn't touching the water. And my brain's going, wait a minute, something ain't right here. Then when it shot straight up in the air and disappeared, back then you didn't talk about this stuff anyway. Mm. You always kept it to yourself because if not, you didn't wind up in a loony bin. So, you know, all these things happened throughout my life and I never really decided. It decided for me.
Mm. I suppose as well, when you have that kind of thing, it's interesting how your brain tries to rationalize it, George. And like you said there, you were thinking, oh, well, it must be off a submarine then, until it does something that obviously a submarine can't do.
Yeah, it's weird the way your mind works and the way the world works, because it's just sometimes they're not in sync.
So was it sort of your traditional disc shape, or was it one of these triangles or anything, George? Or like you say, was it just a sort of shape?
It was just a disc, and you could see the lights around it, and you could see one light in the center on the top, and that's really all you could see. Mm. And the weird thing was, as the ship was going, this thing was, like I said, about 8-9 miles away from the ship, and it would go back and forth and keep up with the ship as it went. Mm. It was kind of, I mean, we weren't flying. We were just cruising through the ocean, but there was nothing else around. Mm. We're in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. And it was just, it never really struck me until a couple of years later. You know, I saw a UFO. I just realized this. You know, nobody ever talked about it. You know, you're young, you're not paying attention. And then it just kind of seeps back into your brain. You go, wait a minute. I remember something happening here. Yeah, it's just weird.
It's remarkable as well, George, because... You know, my uncle was in the British Royal Navy for decades. And I'm aware that there are many a strange tale that seamen and sailors can tell us. And often people focus on strange creatures in the sea and sea monsters and stories such as that. But I've heard numerous first-hand witnesses who have been sailors or seamen in the armed forces that have seen very strange things. And the general consensus is, like you say there, that if you want to do anything with your career, you don't say anything to anyone about anything you may have seen.
Oh, no. No, it's for the longest time, even now, even as much open as it is now to UFO stuff being saw, they still do not want you talking about it. They still try to keep everything secret, which doesn't make sense because it's so much out there now that people are just, they don't even think about it anymore. And we're getting more and more sightings every year because people are actually starting to pay attention and reporting it too, you know. And the same thing with the cryptid creatures and stuff. You used to never hear about, I mean, very seldom did you ever hear about Bigfoot sightings, even though they were going on. People were seeing them, but nobody reported them. Everybody kept them to themselves because they didn't like the ridicule that comes with seeing these creatures. Me, I love it. I'm strange. So, yeah, I've seen four Bigfoot, I've seen ghosts, and I've seen UFOs. I've hit the trifecta. You know?
Well, the Carolinas, I think, is one of the places in the States which is very underrated in regards to its Bigfoot lore and legend, George. But there's dozens and dozens of sightings going back to the native tribes. These are not, as is often put forward for excuses, these are not modern interpretations of everything post-1958. If you can be bothered to the research, the Carolinas has a long history, as certain other states do around the country.
Well, the Appalachian Mountains, where I live at, is one of the oldest mountain chains in the world. It used to, at one time, the Indians and stuff considered them the magic or ancient magic mountains or something like that. I can't remember the exact phrase of it. But they, you know, they held the Appalachians in high regard because of all the weird and strange things that's happened here. I mean, you've got creatures here you may never find anywhere else, just simply because of the legends that build in behind them. You know, it's amazing what all, I really don't know how to phrase it. It's just one of those things where there's so much going on. If you don't see something, you got to kind of wonder what you're not looking at.
Well, exactly. You'd be thinking, why is it not happening to me and everybody else then? Because like you say, there are very strange stories from that whole region.
Oh yeah. I mean, you've got everything from Bigfoot to, was it sheep squatch, where it's half sheep and half Bigfoot? You got dog men, you got werewolves, you got chupacabras, you name it, we got it.
Absolutely, as well as some of the most beautiful scenery in the country as well, George. You're spoiled for choice.
I kind of like it too. I grew up here though, so you know, it's kind of just something natural for me to be out there in the woods. So,
were you sort of one of those people, like you say, because when you've got something like that on your doorstep and you're on such a beautiful expanse of land, like you say, with the Appalachian Mountains being an incredible formation that, as we've said there, have got mysteries and myths and legends attached to them that go back millennia to the very earliest peoples that have lived on the continent. Even into the modern era, there's just all kinds of things going on. Were you someone that, obviously, growing up in that kind of environment, it's very easy to take the next step and become an outdoors person and go hunting and the like, George? So were you sort of out there enjoying your local nature, not looking for big hairy creatures to surprise you? Or was it, did you go out there hoping to see something, but in essence, you were just doing something for sport or for fun?
Well, when I was young, I stayed up in the woods all the time in the mountains. I'd go off by myself. I'd go up, build a lean-to, sleep under my own lean-to, build fires. I did all that by myself, and a lot of times with my friends and stuff. I spent most of my life in the woods. But when as far as Bigfoot stuff goes, I hooked up with some friends of mine that we started a team called NCI, North Carolina Investigates. And then we actually started going looking for them. And I actually seen my first one in East Tennessee, which is the same mountain range, but it's on the other side of the mountain. And that's where I seen my very first one. And I've seen the rest of them on this side of the mountain. So, you know, I've covered both sides so far.
So how old were you when you had your first sort of Bigfoot encounter then, George? Was that something that happened pretty early on? Or is it one of those that It took quite a while for it.
It was actually last year when I had my first encounter.
Wow. So very recent, despite all your interest and experience and time out there.
Yeah, I never went out looking for it before this. I hooked up with my buddy Robert Effler. Me and him started the team together, and we recruited other people. Like we got Tim Dills to join us. We got Harley Owens, and we've got other people to join since then. We've got Jerry Millwood. We got Brian Sawyer. We got several other people that are in our team, but. The first, when we was out looking in East Tennessee, we went over to Harley's area and we were searching. We found all kinds of signs. We started finding twist breaks. We found arches. We found X's. We found a dogman print that was that big. Huge.
Whoa. That's massive.
A dogman print. Yeah, he was huge. We didn't see him, but we seen his print. And we were doing our search, and we'd already went all the way out to where we was going to, and we started coming back. My buddy Harley said, why don't we go down this flat and go across the flat and come up on the other side? And I said, okay, let's do that then. Well, Robert and his wife, Michelle, went down the trail. We went down to the flat. We come up the flat, and we was on the hill. And right straight across from us was another hill about 20 yards away. Mm-hmm. And old Harley punches me. He says, there it is. I said, there what is? That's a shadow. He said, no, I'm telling you, there it is. It's a Bigfoot. I said, dude, that's a shadow. It was overcast and snowy and not really a good day to view things, I guess I should say.
Yeah.
Well, he said, wait right here. I'm going to prove to you that's a Bigfoot. And I said, okay. And I was watching it. He went down the hill. He went down the hill. He stepped on a branch and it said, pow, real loud, like a shotgun. Well, the shadow reached up and grabbed the tree and leaned all the way over to see where he was at. And when it did, it stood straight back up, and I seen where the top of its head was, and I got a little excited because I'm not real smart, so I decided I'm going to chase it. So I take off down the hill. I pass him and come up on the other side where the Bigfoot was. Of course, he's gone, and I got to looking, and where his head was, I measured it was 8.5 feet. He was 4 feet from shoulder to shoulder wide, and we found 3 perfect toe prints in the dirt. You could see where the little toe was. You could see where the big toe was. But 3 middle toes were perfect in that dirt. So we took off to go get him. We took off to chase him. And he had the perfect area set up. Where he was at, on top of this hill, there was laurel thicket behind him, but thick bushes behind him. He had 2 trees and thick bushes on this side, so he could actually hide with no problem. And he went down this little tunnel he had made. He dropped off. We thought he dropped off to the left-hand side. Mm. So we got to the end of the tunnel, and old Robert calls us up. What are y'all doing? Something's tearing the woods up. And there were some birds, and they scared some crows up in over up top of Robert's head when the crows took off.
Yeah.
And when he said that, it stopped. Just stopped dead. So we dropped off on the left-hand side to go down and see if we could get it going again. And we got down there, and the Bigfoot, he just circled back behind us. And we could never see him after that. But he was a big old boy. He was solid black. He had hair sticking up on top of his head like his. So we called him Alfalfa. He had that big conical head.
Yeah.
Had the big shoulders that come up. He didn't look like he had a neck. He was just huge. His arms were like this big around. He was a monster. I mean, he was just a giant creature. And that was the first one I had. Ever since then, I've encountered 2 more small ones. Mm. About 3 to 4 foot high, and I've encountered a 7 foot one.
Mm. So what's the coloration of them, George? Are they all browny black, or are they all different shades? Because obviously this is the thing. People, depending on their interest and knowledge in this, often think that everybody's a ready brown color. But obviously I know enough to know that there's a wide variety of shapes, even to yellow and white in certain encounters.
Yeah, the ones that I've seen have either been black or a reddish brown, or just a dirt brown. Now we have one of our guys, Harley, has actually seen a white one or grayish one, and he's seen a red one. And I think the other guys have seen different colors. I know Robert has talked about a blonde one. It had blonde hair all over it, and it just glimmered when the sun would hit it. It would just glimmer and shimmer.
Do you call these particular characters that you come across, like you mentioned, you'd given the first one you saw a bit of a nickname? Do you have nicknames for them, or you and your team? I mean, often I've spoken to people before, and that they have sort of, it's almost like they not that they want them to be a pet. George, I'm not really sure most of us could cope with anything that's 8.5 foot tall and 4 foot wide, my friend. But I think, as with anything, when you're dealing with animals, whether you work with creatures of the sea, creatures of the land, you see people will sort of name them because they will have personalities and characteristics that are strikingly different from each other.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. These, we have noticed, you know, we've been hunting pretty hard the last few years. And we've noticed that they do have personalities. Some of them are jokesters. I made up this real fancy, I made a like a hornet's nest, and I inset one of my trail cams into it. And I measured up, I'm at 15 feet in the air, hanging up there, showing down to see if I get pictures of these things. Well, the Bigfoot didn't like it. So they took it down and destroyed the bee's nest. But they laid my camera face up 15 feet away from where they destroyed the nest. It's like, you know, it's like here, this, I guess, being small elks or something. Then we've got one, we actually got his arm on video. My buddy Tim has, he puts cameras on his poles and we strap them up in the trees. So they're about anywhere from 12 to 15 foot up. Mm. And there's one camera, one area, wherever that camera, the camera that's over, if it's facing that area, the Bigfoot will move the camera off that trail so they can move back and forth without being seen. So we got one, it's got, you see the arm come around like that and move the camera over. But I think the reason I named my first one is just because it stuck out in my head so much. He had them hairs sticking up. I really not named any rest of them. Now, Robert named the one at his house. He's got a juvenile at his house. He calls it Junior.
Right.
And it's been over around his house. He talks to it and everything else.
Yeah.
So he's never seen it, you know, full body or anything. But we found the footprints. We found different things over there. They indicated it was there and he's heard it. It beat on the side of the house and everything.
Brilliant. I mean, when you guys, do you have a designated area that you know, or you through your experiences and the things that you've come across over the years, George, that you and the rest of the team have a favorite particular area, or do you sort of have a rotating sort of selection of places you like to go to see where these things come, or as with certain states, you've got what seems to be a real Bigfoot hotspot?
Well, around here, the thing I like about around here is the Bigfoot don't really migrate through here. They actually make homes here because of our weather is usually pretty mild all year long. So they're actually making homes here. And one place we got, all the search areas that we're in, it's one area. We got four search areas over there. And there's probably 5 to 6 families that live in that area over there.
Hmm.
You know, we've repeatedly seen the same ones. And over in the East Tennessee area we go, it's a hotbed. I mean, we're running into stuff over there that some of it we can't even explain. It's just like all these different creatures have been moving through there or living over in that area. And we found reptilian prints. We found dogman prints. We found werewolf prints. We found all kinds of stuff our buddy Harley has. And that's going to be one area we're going to hit a lot harder this fall because they really seem to be very, very active in fall over there. They're active all the time, but more in fall than any other time.
Hmm. So when you set out for these kind of expeditions and investigations, George, do you and your team have a sort of favorite way that you like to sort of encourage communication and studying them, or is it a case of you'll try a variety of different things? Because often some people like to just walk about banging on trees. Some people like to call out. Some people like, as you mentioned earlier, set up trail tams, or even as you were mentioning, creating sort of tricks and fake hornet nests to sort of see if you can trick them and pull the wool over their eyes, as it were. So are you one of those sort of teams that tries everything as much as you can, rather than have a specific sort of favorite mode of capturing any evidence?
Well, we have found out just through trial and error, they're really curious. So they know when you get to the woods, they know you're there.
Mm.
And if we laugh, we cut up. If we're having a good time, they're going to come in and check it out.
Mm.
They're going to see what we're laughing and what we're talking about. And we've noticed that as long as we don't pay attention to them too much, you know, we can talk to them. We talk to them all the time anyway. But if we're talking and laughing and cutting up, they'll come in to us. We don't even have to go find them. They'll come to us to investigate us and watch what we're doing. They're curious as they can be. That's what cracks me up about them. Because all these people in USC, all the shows, they're doing all this high-tech stuff, and they're going out at night. It cracks me up. They go out at night, and they're doing all these thermals, and all you're seeing is a thermal image. You're not seeing the creature. You're missing all the sign. You're missing all this stuff because you're going out at night. We go out during the day, and we see all kinds of, you know, all kinds of tracks. We've seen all kinds of twist breaks, the arch trees. We can follow their pattern. We can follow where they're going and where they've been because of all the stuff they leave behind. They'll leave arrows on the ground pointing places like creeks or different places like that. Mm. They'll take like bushes like laurel thickets, and they'll push them up in a line like a hedgerow, and they'll stand behind that and watch you down on the trail when you can't see them. And they're very intelligent. I got information back from a scientist. Her name is Dr. Melba Ketchum. Mm-hmm. And she did a genome project about Bigfoot. And Bigfoot does have some human DNA. And we just figured that they're smart. They're so smart when it comes to those woods, nobody can compete with them. You're not going to trick them. You can dress in camouflage and you can go in there, you're all this stuff. They know you're there. They're watching what you're doing. And if all these shows where they go out there and they got these things set up and you see the infrared things, the Bigfoot can see that infrared. So they avoid it. And we know this because we went through and got trail cams where they poked infrared out with their fingers or with a stick. Now, the camera will be in great shape, but the infrared will be gone. So, you know, a lot of the stuff you're seeing on TV, most of those shows they're not showing you anything real as far as investigations and stuff goes. They're showing what people want to see. Mm. Now, if you watch our show, we show you our real investigations. We don't hide nothing. We don't candy coat nothing. If we don't see it, you don't see it. If we see it and hear it, you get to see it and hear it. I give you a funny incident that happened to us last year. Robert has a really distinctive sneeze.
Right.
And we were out in the woods. Robert was down below us, and we were up to a couple of us was up here. Robert sneezed, and we had two callbacks. Yeah. So just stuff like that. You just got to let them be them, and you know, try not to scare them off when you get there. Mm.
It's strange, isn't it? I suppose it's like ghost hunting. George, it seems that for some reason television has decided we can only do these things at night for some reason. And I'm not really sure where that is, because if you look at any other kind of nature documentary, and regardless of the fact we're talking about cryptids, if you look at any other sort of animal documentary, everybody's out in the day. Unless it's a nocturnal creature, more often than not, there's right. No reason. You know, you never see a gorilla documentary where they're wandering around at midnight in the Congo trying to find things. Because I just don't understand it. Do you think one would be a cynical person, perhaps, George, would suggest that it's easier to pretend things are happening at night because it's not clear, whereas at day, you haven't got the night as an excuse for not much happening, or perhaps Brian from the sound crew hiding behind a tree and just popping his head out every now and again?
Yeah, well, not to be too cynical, it's more for dramatic. I think it's dramatic effect more than anything. You know, and you don't have to prove that it's a Bigfoot. All you got to do is show an image of a thermal unit moving through there. Since there's no comparison, because you can't compare a thermal image to anything while you're looking through it, you can't get a definition size through that unless you have a person standing there, then a thermal image on the other side, which is much bigger. Then you have a comparison. But unless you have a way, like in the daytime, if I show you something and it's over by a tree and it leaves and I go by the tree and you see it's 2.5 feet higher than me, then you know it's 8.5 feet high because I'm 6 foot tall. Mm. And in the day, like I said, we do most of our stuff in the day. And I think what they do is they set stuff up and they move through and they forage. And at night's when they do the majority of their hunting, because they hunt deer. They hunt hogs. And that's when the food's out. So they set up all these elaborate, and I do mean elaborate, ambush areas where they can ambush their prey and they get to eat without burning as much energy. They're so big they can't, you know, they can outrun a deer and grab it and break its neck and kill it and eat it. But that burns so many calories, they don't want to do that. What they do is they set up these ambush points. You send something down here to scare the deer. The deer runs up this area you've got designed for them to come through. And as they come through, they grab and snap her neck or break her legs off. We've seen this. We've seen the kill sites. I've seen three different kill sites. And you can see one of them, it was actually real impressive. There was a field down below where the deer come and graze and stuff at night and everything. And they had fixed it to where the deer had, if they scared them, the deer had to run up this ravine, which come up, and they had laid logs out to guide the deer into a certain area. And what most likely what happened, because they never hunt alone, they always hunt together. They'll run up that ravine and come around to that area. As soon as they get to that one site, they could just kill as many as they wanted to for supper. And we found it. We found different kill sites around that area where they broke the legs off, where the deer couldn't be mobile, and they'd come back later and kill them and eat them.
That's remarkable, really. But it also, like you say, it shows the level of intelligence that is often not given to creatures at all in any form, really, George, because, as you say, if you're going to eat deer and hog, these are fast creatures. Hogs especially are extremely underrated for the speed that they can travel. And I've seen numerous documentaries about some of the states that are having real issues with feral hog populations in the thousands, sort of, and you simply can't track them down because they're so quick. And even if you do get the chance, you have to send your dogs in Kevlar body armor because of the tusks. You know, these are not what you would consider your domesticated pig. You know, most of them just tend to waddle about and might give you a nasty nip if you get too close. But a hog and a boar, especially one with a boar in the family unit, can really cause you a lot of problems, both if you're 8 foot tall, I don't care how big and wide you are, a gash from one of their tusks is really going to hurt you, and obviously could kill a man quite easily.
Oh, yeah. I've seen hog with, 6-8-inch tusk on them. And I think the way the Bigfoot, I have a tendency to believe that because Bigfoot do throw rocks and they use wood and they use rocks, they use tools. I think that's part of what they use when they use the hogs. Or they'll grab them by the back legs and slam them into a tree and kill them. Because we've seen trees that has chunks or something that has hit it hard and there'll be hair or something on the tree. And you can tell it's not Bigfoot hair. I mean, I've seen enough hair on hogs and bear and deer and stuff like that. I know the difference in them when I look at them. But I think they're smart enough to know that, hey, you can't just run down there. That thing will eat you up. So they bash it with a rock or something. Because they've thrown rocks at us. I had one miss my head by about 16 inches. It came right by my ear. And it was just to distract us because there were little ones on ahead of us.
Yeah.
So they would do stuff over here to draw your attention from over here so that you don't know what's going on. And they're a lot smarter people to give them credit for.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Have you noticed any differences in the way they behave depending on which state you're in? As you mentioned earlier on, you do in the Carolinas, you cross over into Tennessee. Obviously, I would imagine you've been in other states on the hunt as well, George. So do you notice, as we were talking about personalities and things, one of the things that you will often find if you really dig deep into what's going on in certain southern states or in the East Coast compared to what happens on the West Coast and the Northwest, up in the Pacific Northwest specifically, you can clearly see very different sort of shapes, sizes, behavior, family units from people that have experienced it. For you, is that what you've come across as well, even if it is fairly close from the Carolinas to Tennessee, but it's not exactly, we're not talking about just 100 miles here, we're talking a fair distance.
Right. Well, the thing is, if you notice the ones in like the Carolinas, Georgia, Tennessee, Virginia, West Virginia, these areas, you're looking at anywhere on average between 7 and 9 feet. That's usually about what the Bigfoot stay. Mm. Now, when you go down towards Florida and you start looking at the skunk apes and the Bigfoot down there, you're looking at a thinner Bigfoot. You know, it's a lot thinner than what they are here. But then when you go out west and you start getting down to Midwest and all that, you're looking at really big Bigfoot. You're talking anywhere from 9 to 12 feet high, or maybe bigger. It just depends. And they migrate out there. They actually follow the herds as they migrate, you know, farther west or to east. They follow them. Here they don't. Down south in Florida, they don't migrate. They may have some come through, but most of the time those stay in a certain area all the time. And in the south areas especially, then you've got other creatures mixed in with them, like you've got the feral monkeys, you've got stuff like that, that where they've escaped from zoos, or they was in a, like Ringling Brothers back in the 70s had a train crash and a bunch of orangutans and chimps escaped from that. And they've grown up out in the swamps and stuff, and they're feral, and they've developed like they would have in the wild, and they've multiplied like that. So you've got all these different creatures, and they're all going to be different depending upon where they're at. But I think I like our area because we kind of know what they're doing. We kind of have an idea where they're at, and we've actually, you can almost watch the little ones grow up. I mean, we've seen alfalfa from the time we first seen him till now. He's changed. He's got bigger. He's got thicker. His attitude hasn't changed. He's still kind of a, I'm going to come by and let you see me, but you're not going to see me good attitude, because Harley has seen him a couple of times, just watched him on the backside of the trees and stuff.
Yeah.
And I think last time we were out there, what was funny is we were walking in a line. I always walk in the back. I'm always the back guy for some reason. It was me and then my buddy Robert, and Harley was up front. And we had something you couldn't see, but there was something paralleling us as we was walking down the trail. So I was watching up to the left-hand side to see what was watching us, what was following us. And you could hear it stepping. It was bipedal. You could hear the steps. You could, you know, determine what it was, but you couldn't see anything. And all of a sudden, Robert starts hollering, "Whoa, whoa, whoa." And there was one in front of us that come down and stopped. And he seen it. And then, and Harley was looking off to the right-hand side. So he didn't see it. So he backed off. And when he did, the Bigfoot took off down to the bottom. Well, Harley seen it when it went down the woods. Him and Robert said, "I never did see it because I was watching on the other side." So, you know, it's, they're that smart. They know how to manipulate you to turn your head the opposite way.
Is it intriguing when you finally realize how clever they are, George, that you think this isn't as easy as some people like to make out? Because often you will hear people talk about them, and I've often been very surprised when they seem to talk them as if they're really simplistic. And I thought, well, we wouldn't have this conundrum that we've got as many people as we have having these fleeting experiences rather than, I mean, obviously a lot of people have had some rather hair-raising face-to-face encounters, and some have been rather there for the grace of God go them rather than me, and good luck to them. I hope they manage to get some sleep after what happens to them. But often when you speak with people that go out in the woods a lot, outdoors people, hunters and things like that, the thing that often strikes me is that they can clearly tell that these are a certain level of intelligence, far more than a deer or a hog or a bear or something. It can manipulate a situation so it gets out of the way far quicker than anything else. Because often, you know, you can shine a light at a deer and it freezes if you catch it right. Whereas these guys, they wouldn't give you that opportunity.
Well, the funny thing, and I've noticed this on several different occasions, you can be standing right beside them and never know they're there. We were at a hunt and we didn't even know it happened. One of the people online had seen the video and they contacted us and said that there was a dog man come around the side of us as we were sitting there talking. We didn't hear him. And come to find out, he was actually about 10 feet behind me and I had no idea he was there. And these creatures, they can blend in so well. And if you ever look, we had Tim Deals has some of the hair, and we looked at the hair real closely. And if you look at it, it's actually tri-colored. They'll be like brown, brownish red, and then a clear area. Then it'll go into, say, brown or something. And that basically that means they can camouflage themselves in by using, they can, you know how a bear or something will move its fur or a moose or something will move its fur around and change the way it looks to a degree. Yeah. I think they can do that. And I think that's what they use as camouflage when they're trying to, they want to watch you, but they don't want you to see them. I don't know about all these portals. A lot of people talk about portals and these things going invisible. I have a little bit harder time with that because I've never seen it. I've seen them walk. I've seen a deer. I've seen a moose, matter of fact, one time I was up Maine. This giant moose, big bull moose, the big horns. I seen it take three steps into the woods and you couldn't see it anymore.
Yeah.
You could hear it, but you couldn't see it. And I think that they know how to use the camouflage to get them to where it looks like they disappear, but they really don't.
So I suppose for a lot of people, the sort of reality of Bigfoot is not to be challenged, really. They're quite convinced about it. For you, George, what was it like coming into a situation where you're coming across people who are talking about dog men and saying that they've found footprints and things like that? Because obviously this is one of the things that's kind of exploded over the last 30 years, primarily from the sightings up north in Michigan and Wisconsin. But you've certainly got southern states with a long history, like Louisiana, Tennessee, that have history of werewolf or loup-garou stories from that particular area. Were you, as you said, you're quite sort of down to earth when you're talking about these particular subjects and your personal experiences. Was it hard to get your head around, or were you one of those people that went, well, if a big, hairy, bipedal ape-like creature can be out here, why can't there be some kind of 7-foot menacing dog-like creature running about as well?
Well, I'm one of these weird people that grew up reading science fiction and everything, so nothing really surprises me. And I got to study, I researched the dog band, and you know, we around the states, we believed it didn't come around till you know Louisiana come around first, and we heard it up in Michigan. Kind of find out dog men go all the way back to ancient times. There actually were tribes of dog men that were mentioned by Marco Polo and Christopher Columbus, like in India. They used to be tribes in Africa, India, and other places. Well, the one they actually believed Anubis came from the tribe in Africa, and that tribe was wiped out by disease and baboons. They believed that tribe was wiped out, that they got sick and was unable to fight back. And these big baboons come in and killed them and ate them. And over in India, there were actually, that tribe in India was actually 120,000 strong, is what Marco Polo, talked about in his journals. And they communicated by barks and yaps. And they hunted. And they were actually great warriors that later on, some of the other cultures talked about recruiting them and pulling them in and used them for mercenaries. During the Catholic Saints War, one of the saints actually went over to India and recruited them as his personal bodyguards. Saint Christopher was believed to have been a dog man. Matter of fact, he was drawn as a dog man for a long time until I think his age of wonderment or whatever it was come in, and they changed all of them to look in a certain way. All the pictures of the saints and stuff. So these creatures have been around for a long time. Now, there is a difference between a dog man and a werewolf. The dog man still have a human-style legs and everything, like a human, but they have a dog head and they have some dog features other than just their head. Now, a werewolf looks like a dog walking on two legs and it has the reverse bent legs like a dog does, haunches. And it's a whole different ballgame, and that actually come over from over in Europe, the werewolf did. The stories about the werewolf. I'm actually, in the new book I'm working on, I'll be talking about that.
I suppose one of the challenges is as well, because there is often, once again, we're talking about the intelligence of cryptids, George. The thing that often gets mentioned when people are talking about encounters with dogmen or man wolves or whatever people like to label them as, is that there seems to be a sort of malicious intent, but there is also this kind of arrogance with them that they just like to make sure that you know you're really frightened. And if they wanted to, they could just rip you to bits if they fancied a nibble on anybody unsuspectingly walking in their areas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they do too. I think the dog men, especially, they want to be intimidated. They want you to know, look, I'm the king here. Bigfoot, not quite as much, because the Bigfoot, I think, will slap all of them down. I think they're actually the top predator out there, I think, is the Bigfoot. Just because they're more intelligent, they're incredibly strong. They're stronger than the Dogman by a long shot. And I think that the Dogmen carry a grudge on their shoulder, because they were, you know, there were tribes at one time of these things, and they all got wiped out one way or another, would have been disease or just, you know, pulled apart or whatever. And I think that they're around the world now, and they're still ticked off about what happened back in the old days.
Well, why wouldn't you be? Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, yeah, I mean.
So do you have any particular locations that you and your teammates have gone out looking for this? And have you been able to notice similarities, you know, as we've been talking about the family units of Bigfoots and the way that they seem to have personalities and a sense of humor almost? Is there anything like this, or do they seem to be sporadic individuals that seem to be just eking out a living in the wild?
I think it varies. I think that because of the way the Bigfoot clan works or the family units work, what we can assess so far, what we believe so far happens is they have the little ones, they grow up, and once they get to a certain age, they kick them out to start their own clans to find their own mates and do their own thing. Yeah. And, this clan continues on, or the young one will kick out the old one. And whichever one's kicked out, they have a really bad attitude for a while. Those ones you got to worry about. Those ones you got to worry about being dangerous is what they call the rogue Bigfoot. The ones that no longer have a clan, no longer have extra Bigfoot to help it hunt, and they're on their own. But overall, I think the Bigfoot themselves seem to be a lot more laid back, and they just want to see you, but they don't want you to see them. Now, Dogmen are different, and I mean, every creature is different. They all have their own attitudes. But overall, I think the Bigfoots are more, unless you push them and you make them mad, I think usually they try to stay away from everybody, even the ones you got in England.
I mean, are you surprised at how prevalent Dogman's become, George? Because as we said at the beginning, you're somebody that's had a real interest in strange things for all your life, as I have. And you can kind of see that the reports sort of started 30, 35 years ago, really, that became common knowledge and have continued to develop and grow to the point now that you've got a real sort of body of evidence and numerous witnesses all over the US who have had strange encounters with technically a creature that isn't supposed to exist at all ever.
Well, I think the funny thing about the Dogman is, now this is just a theory, I have nothing really to back it up other than what we've seen and what we've noticed. I think the Dogman and Bigfoot are actually working together as far as gathering food and taking care of their families and stuff. It just seems now I've read stories, a place called the LBL, it's over in Kentucky.
Yep.
And there used to be what they called the Bigfoot Dogman Wars. They actually fought against each other for territory. And I think they've actually come to a point now, it's like, okay, we'll all live here and just share everything. And they've actually started using the Dogman. Like, I think they've actually used them, like when I was talking about that ambush area. I think they send the Dogman to the field to run the deer, personally. And that way they don't have to expend as much energy because they're so much thicker than the Dogman are. They're thicker and stronger, so they don't want to burn up all them calories. So the Dogman are running around anyway. So they use them almost like hunting hounds.
Yeah.
I really believe they are, because when we seen that big print, we were pushing that Dogman. We didn't even realize it, but we were pushing him. And he came in front of us, and he hit a mud slick down below us on the trail, not more than 3 to 5 minutes before we got there, because when we got there, the water had already started coming back into the print.
Ah.
It was slid through the mud. So he couldn't have been 3 to 5 minutes ahead of us. And that's also the same place we've seen the Bigfoot. So they have to be worked together. If not, the Bigfoot would just kill him. Because he couldn't have been more than seven feet high. And he had to be skinny because his track wasn't super deep. But I mean, it's deeper than I could make my footprint. But it wasn't deep like a Bigfoot print.
Yeah.
So I'd say he was probably 300-400 pounds. and alfalfa was probably closer to 800 pounds. So, you know, it's one of those deals like, they're tough, but I don't think they're that tough.
Well, I suppose as well, you see this in all parts of the world in nature, George, that you will have very different species that seem to be able to exist in a way that benefits them both. And they try to not have conflict at all, because at the end of the day, they're all just trying to survive. It's not beyond the realms of possibility, because I know a lot of people have said, well, if you've got Bigfoots there, you're probably going to have a dogman there. So there has to be some kind of relationship on some level, because otherwise, like you say, you'd have hikers stumbling across the fight of all fights in the middle of a wood on occasions, I would imagine. And I don't think anybody would want to be anywhere near that kind of thing.
No, I agree with you 100%. I really do. What's funny is it's almost like the Bigfoot control them more, because if they didn't and they started attacking humans, then that would draw more sight to them. It would draw authorities to come in that area. It would draw people in more with guns and everything else trying to find out what's going on. And the Bigfoot, you know, they don't want that, so they try to keep them in check so they don't attack humans. So it keeps the authorities and keeps people with guns. I mean, they're smart enough to come out, they're smart enough to figure this out. We were out there in the woods, and if I see one and I'm just watching it, if my hand drops down beside my pistol, they'll leave. They'll disappear. But as long as my hand's not close to my pistol, they'll watch you all day long. And we go armed, because when you get out there in the woods, walk where we go to, you've got wild hogs, you've got bear, you've got coyotes, you've got red wolves, you've got snakes. That's what I carry the gun for. I'm not carrying the gun to shoot Bigfoot. I actually like him better than I do the snakes by a long shot. I don't do snakes. But and you just got to have something to protect yourself, because if you get, say you come up in an area and you've cornered a wild hog, he'll rip you to shreds to get out of there. And them tusks could cut you just like a razor blade.
I suppose when you look at your body of work as well, George, I mean, one of the things that struck me is you're one of those authors that seems to be quite well read in regards to certain places that get overlooked, because, you know, you cover certain legends from the Caribbean, from other places that are often overlooked. I mean, the Lusker is a prime example, some of the stories about that. For you, is it quite frustrating sometimes that people seem to think that North America finishes at the American-Canadian border and the American-Mexican border, and it doesn't go out anywhere and nobody else cares? Because obviously you've got some incredible stories from some of the countries in the Caribbean.
It does. And the whole reason I started doing these books is when I was young, our grandparents or our parents would set us down and tell stories about the local area. They would tell us, you know, the ghost stories, they'll tell us the legends and different things about the area. Like one of the stories when I was growing up, we have a place called Helen's Bridge. And one of the stories was there was a single mother had a house up at the edge of the bridge, and she worked for the mansion that was on the other side of the bridge up on the hill. And different things happened, and the mansion caught on fire, and they was there trying to fight the fire. But her little girl was trapped in the house, and she could see her, and she seen her die. And the house was completely lost, and she was just totally distraught, you know, she could not be consoled. And that night, she hung herself from the bridge. And now the story is that her ghost and the ghost of her child haunts that area. They wander about the bridge. Different things happen. I've seen the full body apparition of Helen. I've been chased by the fireball that was her daughter. I've seen the orbs moving through the air and all that. So I've seen all that myself. So I know it was there. And that's one of the stories I put in my books. I want people, you know, when I was young, it was always cool to get this stuff handed down to us. And that's what I'm trying to do. I want to give people of different regions and different areas the stories that should have been handed down to them. Like I just finished working on a story for, was it Albania? I think it's Albania. I'm doing a new book. It's a European edition.
Yeah.
But I did one about the dwarf king of Sassenberg. And the story is incredible. It's just an amazing story about this king dwarf who was so beloved by his people, and they loved him because he was smart, he was fierce, he was just as kind as he was fierce. And he was just a great king, and they followed him no matter what, and he had more riches than any human up above the ground above him. And of course, they were. He was working with. He was trading back and forth with merchants and with the people. And along comes this greedy duke, who wants it all and declares war against the dwarf king. And this war breaks out, and it lasts for a long time. But then there's one human. I won't tell you what happens. Anyway, it's just a great story. You know, stuff like that, I love to read. I love to write about. And all these stories, I try not to change any of them too much because I want people to get the stories from their area. I want to really enjoy reading it and not my version of what happened. But I'll throw some of me into the stories and I'll make it a little, I try to make it a little bit more where it grabs you and holds your attention more. But I want people to have their own stories back. They're not getting them passed down like they used to. And I want people to have those stories so they can. You know, if you have the stories of where you're from, it means more to you than if you're reading stories on TV, you're watching TV and stuff like that. At least these stories will mean something to you. And that's what I'm all about. I want people to really relate to the areas where they're from, you know, where their family was from and their history and all that. I'm a history nut, so that's what I like about all the stories.
Well, I think it's vitally important. I think it's often, it's easy for people to kind of fall into that trap of getting really into something that's happening half the world away, George, and just not understanding or knowing about anything that's happened around the corner from them. And I think, like I said, it really struck me that you're one of the few people that seems to have taken the time to even look at some of the islands of North America, because, as I say, other than probably Hawaii or Vancouver, most people wouldn't give a damn about anything else.
Oh, and they're great stories. You know, you got stories coming out of Greenland that are just, you're reading, you're going, wow. You know, and I just want to give people the stories I can enjoy that will actually mean something to them. And I'm kind of jealous because, you know, I'm 100% American and all that, but some of the best stories is from Europe. I mean, let's face it, you guys have been around longer than we have, and you've got the dragons and you've got the werewolves and the banshees and all these medieval stories that come up from the medieval times and before that, that are just, they're incredible. I grew up reading, you know, I read about Robin Hood and all these King Arthur and all that. But now I'm actually researching the true stories behind them to pass on because it's getting lost. It's getting lost with dramatic TV shows that blow everything out of proportion. You don't really get the true story behind it. Mm. It's like the movie Jaws here.
Yes.
There's a true story behind it.
Yes.
It was based off of a little kid that got attacked by a bull shark in fresh water. Didn't even happen in the ocean. And there was everybody went crazy about this. And after they found this kid had been killed by the shark, then they started they got a few more attacks out in the ocean. And they wiped out a crap load of sharks trying to get all these different sharks. And it was a bull shark.
Yeah.
You know. A big bull shark. We're talking, I think it was 6.5 or something feet long. So I want people to know the real thing, what really happened, the real stories or the real myths and stuff. So I want everybody to enjoy it.
Well, exactly. I mean, there's a prime example of that in Jaws where they just start killing every shark they find, even though it's, you know, it can't possibly be what's happening because they don't have that sort of ability to take a step back and think, hang on a minute, what's happened here? Because, you know, up until this point, like you say, it's quite a well-reported. I mean, one of the strangest things about that was that somebody else got killed trying to save that kid because the shark was just in a frenzy, George. And it's remarkable that even to this day and age, you will still see people talk about stories of sharks living in bodies of water in North America. And they'll always say it's a great white or a hammerhead. And you're like, well, it can't be. But it can be a bull shark. And the ability that bull sharks have to be able to sort of switch their skill sets from salt water to fresh is what probably elevates them to a very dangerous fish. Obviously, perhaps not as fearsome a reputation as the great white, but you're as likely to be attacked by a bull as a great white, if not more so more often, because bulls have that ability to swim upstream.
Yeah. And I mean, there's so many misconceptions that, and you tell these stories, people will start understanding more about the way that everything really does work instead of being led by their TV or their, you know, whatever on TV they're watching and getting this falsehood that sticks in their mind instead of what really happened and stuff. So, you know, that's what I like to do, stuff like that. And I'm enjoying the crap out of the European edition. I got to be honest, it's awesome.
Well, there is plenty going on here from sort of Siberia all the way down to the tip of Italy, if you look for it, George. And often, once again, like you say, there are certain things that seem to have got overlooked. But now, troll, like you were saying about Dwarf Kings and things like that, the troll legends in Scandinavia are a prime example of that, that I think people just dismiss them as folklore. Now, especially what happened with Flores Island in the Pacific and discovering that we did have small hairy ancestors that lived up until very recently, the longer we explore those regions, I think the closer to us they're going to get. It's not beyond the realms of possibilities that's what people are talking about when they talk about trolls, even to the extent that people up until right now seem to believe that it's still out there. And therefore now people are thinking, well, is it simply a small version of Bigfoot that we've just never looked at properly? We just thought these were old myths, legends, and folklore.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I really do.
It's surprising, though, that I think some of these stories are now getting a little bit more sort of critical analysis, and people are beginning to think that, yeah, these aren't just tall tales told to keep children inside when it gets dark. George, there's a real sort of reality to some of these.
I'm hoping that the stories I put out will help people and give them that urge to go research it. You know, I give you a little bit of the story. I don't give you the whole story because half these stories, one story would do a whole book by itself. Yeah. I want to give you enough where you go, I need to go check that out. I want to see if this is real. And I want to give people that. When we heard it, the first thing we went and did is go to the Helen's Bridge. When we heard it, we went to Brown Mountain to go see the lights. Anytime we heard these stories, we had to go investigate it because we were kids. That's what we did, you know. There's not a lot to do around here other than hunting or go do stuff like that. So yeah. I want people to get that urge back. I want that adventurism, that, you know, that curiosity, that scientist interest in saying, okay, I want to explain what this is. Because we're seeming to lose that. We're, you know, everything's worried about the technology of this or the technology of that, and not getting out and saying, okay, I can use this technology to find out what this is. I can use this technology to see if this is real or not real. And I want that for everybody. I want everybody to get that when they read my books. I'm not doing it just for the heck of it. I'm doing it because I actually want people to get going and get off, you know, off their butt to go check this stuff out. So, you know, that's just me.
Well, I think it's frustrating because some people will just dismiss it and go, well, we know where everything is and you know, we've filmed everything. But as I've said before on previous shows, just because you've flown a drone over a wood or a forest doesn't mean you know what lives there. You've got no idea unless you go.
No, that we don't know nowhere near as much as we think we do. I've got two national forest here. There's over 1 million acres there. People are, we hike that. You hike about that much of it on your best day. I mean, everybody. I mean, the Appalachian Trail's been walked, but it's only because it's clear.
Yes.
And you're only on the trail. You're not even checking the things off the side of the trail. You know, so, I mean, there's so much out there. People just don't really have a clue. They think that they know. They live in a little bubble that thinks, hey, we know what's going on. No, they don't.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Well, absolutely. And I think often when you're in that kind of place, you're on a designated trail George, and usually you'll have a designated spot that's been created for a great picture. But like you say, you can have lines of trees either side of you, and there could be Bigfoot on one side of you and the Dogman's on the other, and just walking along with you, keeping your eye on you, making sure you make it to that beautiful view to take that wonderful selfie in front of the sunset or something.
Yeah, and he might even photobomb you. I've seen pictures that there's people that didn't believe in Bigfoot or anything else, but if you look at the picture real closely, I looked at one not too long ago. This lady's taking this beautiful selfie. She's got this selfie going, and you can see the eyes in the background. Mm. If you look real close, you see the eyes watching her. It's like, oh, okay.
That's a very different kind of selfie spot, I think.
Definitely. I will definitely agree with you on that.
I suppose as well, the other kind of cryptids we've not touched on is the numerous flying ones from all over the place. There seems to be stories of all kinds of strange things seen in the sky. And once again, this is, as you say, we don't know anywhere near as much as we like to tell everybody we do, I think. The amount of stories of giant flying creatures over the states and even into some of the islands is numerous. And once again, you seem to have different areas with different things. And yes, people will always say, probably the most famous weird flying creature that in the modern era is Mothman. But you only have to look at some of the stories from sort of the 19th century, some of the tribe legends, some of the tribe stories about these things. There's all sorts there. For you, when you're looking into this, is it still quite surprising how anything like that seems to be completely dismissed unless you are really into the particular subject? Because flying cryptids seem to be the one thing that seems to be taken less seriously for some reason, even though they're in the air. Most people don't even look up when they're walking normally, George, never mind out in the countryside.
Oh, yeah, you're exactly right. That's one area, like you said, that nobody pays attention to. I had, when I wrote Monsters of the World, I had a lady as up in Indiana sent me an encounter that she had with this flying creature with talons, and she wrote the whole thing out and told me about what they had seen there last, and it was corroborated by her son, mm-hmm. who seen it. And I mean, this stuff happens so many, and the thing I've been really amazed by here lately was the pterodactyl sightings.
Yes.
There has been so many pterodactyl sightings all over the world. And then you've got, up in West Virginia, you've got a thing called, what they call a snallygaster.
Yep.
It's basically a pterodactyl that has survived. And, I mean, there's tons and tons of giant birds. There's one that was believed to have been a cryptid till they actually found it a little while back. And it was called, what's that one called, baby? Has a big head. There's an owl it's an eagle that they just found not that long ago that was believed to have been a cryptid. But it's a huge eagle. Has a human helmet-like face to it. And that was confused for a long time. And then they finally got footage and tracked it down and found where it lived and everything else. I can't for life remember what it was. I do apologize.
That's all right. That's all right. I mean, even something as insignificant as a parrot, George, they've had such a thing in Australia where they've had this real sort of problem with the night parrot, which was apparently extinct. And then somebody said they'd found it and everybody said he'd lied about it. And then it ended up, they were all sat in a tree that nobody bothered looking at. And there's hundreds of the bloody things, and they're nowhere near extinct. But these are people who've spent their lives looking for this thing in Australia, and it was there all along. They just looked in the wrong place, which just shows you.
Oh, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. One of the funniest things I've ever read in my life, they sent this scientist down to Africa to find this rare, extinct elephant. You know, they sent him down there, and he's looking everywhere for this thing. But they sent this guy down here to find this elephant, and he searched and searched all over Africa, trying to find it and everything else. And he went up to found a tribe out there, and he went up to the tribe leader and was asking him about the elephant. The tribe leader looked at him kind of funny. He said, "What, that one?" He pointed it, walked right across behind him, a whole herd of them. You know. You look too hard, you can't find it. If you just let it happen, it'll find it.
Yeah.
But that's just proof that, you know, everybody out there, you know, prove Bigfoot. I don't have to prove it. I've seen it. Yeah. I know he's out there. I ain't got to prove it to nobody. So,
yeah.
Yeah. It cracks me up when all these, the funniest thing that cracks me up is when people go, well, there's no bones. Well, yeah, there's bones out there, but you can't distinguish them from another creature if you don't see it when it's fresh. Because if you leave a body out there in the woods, any kind of body, whether it be a deer, bear, Bigfoot, whatever, it gets gone quickly. The meat gets eaten, the hair goes away, even the bones. Animals will bite the bones and suck out the marrow to get the proteins.
Yeah.
And the bones will, you got insects, you've got bacteria and everything else that eats it all away, along with the acidic soil. Soil is very acidic. And it just, the bones and everything just disintegrate.
Yeah.
If you're not there within a certain period of time, you ain't going to find it anyway.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can see that. I mean, one of the tragedies of when they're looking for humans that have gone missing in certain places, George, is that often they will have to have a big search area because animals will scatter the skeleton. They'll just carry bits off and go for a wander and think, right, I'm going over here to have a bit of lunch.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And if they wait too long, like I said, between the bugs and the creatures and the ground, they just disintegrate. And that's been proven. We actually have a body farm over in, I think it's Kentucky. And you can see the stages of decomposition.
Yeah,
we're the phase away. I can't talk today. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Where you can see how decomposition happens to a body at different levels and different stages.
Yeah.
And that's more controlled than what it is out in the woods.
Yeah.
And just the calcium in the bones and the, you know, and the bone marrow and all that, animals that love that stuff.
Mm.
And they'll suck on the bones and bite on the bones and suck the marrow out just for the proteins.
Yeah. I mean, it is fascinating. I know what you mean, because obviously it's used a lot for the FBI and crime prevention in regards to that, the body farm, George, because obviously they, as you say, they set scenarios up so that it shows the level of decomposition in certain, you know, they'll put a body in water, they'll put a body under cardboard, they'll wrap it in blankets, they'll put it in plastic bags, and they'll create these environments that give people that experience. So, like you say, just how a body reacts in West Virginia is not going to be how a body reacts in Washington State, and it's going to be nothing like what would happen to a body in Florida, would it?
Oh, no, not even close. Now, there's so many variables. It's to say, well, you ain't found bones is really a really bad argument, because it don't matter what you're looking for. I mean, you're looking at, like I said, we've got two places that are a million acres. If one Bigfoot dies in 6 months, how am I going to find it? I mean, my team can only cover so much area. I mean, that's just the way it is. And you don't know where they're at. So unless you know where their bedding is, unless you know where they make their home at, you'll never be able to find the bodies and stuff. I don't care. I mean, sometimes it's hard just to find a deer body in the woods or a bear. And we know there's plenty of them.
Yeah.
So, exactly. It's a lower number of critters in a big area. So you're not going to find it.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm unaware of ever seeing a bear skeleton that somebody stumbled across in a wood, George, unless it's been shot by somebody and they know where they killed it and they go there straight away. But in the wild, you know, you can count the occasions on one hand for most people. Most hunters never see a bear skeleton in their lives.
Oh, I know. We found a kill area over in South Mountain, and we found this area we found three of them, but the last area we got to, we found three dead deer parts of them in this area. And for some reason, we don't know why, but the Bigfoot actually set one of the bodies up in the tree.
Hmm.
Now, it was set there because the neck, which would be the heaviest part of that corpse, was sitting straight up, just like it was sitting there.
Mm.
And when we took it down, the neck had been, the bones had been twisted 180 degrees.
Oof.
And nothing but the skull plate was left onto the skeleton. And just to check our theory, we threw it back up out of the weeds. Now, the limbs were no bigger around than my pinky or less. So we know a cougar didn't put them up there. We know a bobcat didn't put them up there because they'd have broke the limbs. They'd been too heavy.
Yeah.
So we threw the bones back up there to see how they would land, to see if they were thrown up there by somebody or they were set. When we threw them, of course, the neck being the heaviest part come down first, and the ribs hung it up, so the neck was hanging down. Mm. But when we found the neck was up, it had been set perfect, yeah, like it was alive or something, set it there like that. And then we found the jawbone, which, you know, a jawbone shaped like this with the bones coming down,
yeah,
to the front teeth, was set on a limb like this. 6 foot, 6.5 foot up in the air away on the right beside the other tree where we found the bones in the tree. Mm. It was funky. We don't know why they do it, but I think they did it as some sort of a signal, like, okay, here's where the food is or something like that. Because like I said, we found three parts of other deer on the bottom where the, one of them had had his leg completely broken off,
yeah,
where they had broken to demobilize it. And so you'd eat it. Hmm. You can see the gnaw marks on the bones too. It wasn't sharp teeth. It was flat like our teeth. It was more like our teeth than what it was like a dog's teeth, how they'll actually gash in.
Yeah.
Or a flat tooth will scrape it.
Mm. Remarkable. Remarkable. Yeah. Let's hope that's what they're saying in that, that it's here's the food rather than anything else, George.
I hope so, because if I ain't, I ain't going back over.
Yeah, that's a barbecue you don't want to interfere in.
You're right. I agree with you on that 100%. I don't want to be invited to that one, no.
Yeah, it's a cookout for somebody else, that. Good luck. All the best for you. Before I let you go, George, obviously I know you mentioned it earlier, your next book, you're going to be taking a trip around Europe. So how's that been? How have you found that? Because like you say, as you said earlier, we seem to have a lot more strange stories going on here. Have you stumbled across something that you weren't very aware of or didn't know anything about and thought, this is just brilliant. Why do I not know anything about this particular creature?
Oh, I'm finding fantastic stories. I'm telling you, there's 50 countries that I found in Europe, right? And the smaller countries, I never really thought about, like Albania or Armenia and none of those countries. I never really thought much about those. They're just little countries in Europe. Oh, the stories are fantastic. And in this book, I have the story of Nimrod in there. Mm. I'm going to have the real story of Robin Hood, the real story of King Arthur. Of course, I'm going to have cryptid creatures. I'm going to have like the banshees up in Ireland. No, yeah, Ireland. I'm going to have Loch Ness Monster. I'm going to do about it. I mean, there's just so many fantastic stories. I'm enjoying writing this, I hate to say it, even more than I did in the USA, just simply because there's just the stories from the Middle Ages and stuff. And we didn't have Middle Ages over here. So, it's going to be one of those. It's going to have all kinds of fantastic stories. I'm trying to do at least 5 to 6 stories per country. Mm. It's really hard to slam down to that many, but it's going to be a 500-page book for the look of it. So I really want people to enjoy it. I'm writing stories I'm hoping everybody will enjoy.
Brilliant. When's that expected to be released then, George? How far into it are you?
We're looking at probably around Christmas.
Mm.
That way hopefully I'll get it out so people can order it for Christmas presents and stuff.
Yeah. And is that going to be with Beyond the Fray again?
It will be, yes. They asked me to write it.
Ah. Well, that always helps, doesn't it?
It does. It was really nice. And now that we've got, I have a channel called Channel 12 TV Network.
Mm.
We actually, if you watch it, it's on Hulu and all that. So if y'all watch, if you subscribe to our channel, you'll get to see all kinds of paranormal stuff. You'll get to see our hunts. You'll get to see movies. We got everything on there. We've got wrestling. We've got all kinds of different shows like Body Slamming Conversations. We've got Tracy the White Witch Paranormal. We've got all kinds of. We got Travel Channel that tells you about going on cruises and stuff like that.
Hmm.
And we have everything to offer. We're just hoping we get more subscribers over in the UK, especially because we just now got to the UK. They're just now letting our channel come over there.
Hmm.
So we're hoping people will subscribe and check us out. You'll hear about the hunts. You'll hear about all the crazy stuff we do.
Fabulous. Well, George, listen, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a real pleasure to finally speak to you. And I hope I get a chance to speak to you about your next book, because that sounds fascinating. Where can everybody find your previous work, follow you online? And like you say, check out this channel and follow your work all over the place.
Well, besides being on Channel 12 TV Network, I'm on Facebook, I'm on Instagram, I'm on everything. let's leave it at that. I'm on TikTok and all that stuff. So if y'all look me up on there, you can put me on Google and pull me up that way. I'm everywhere. I'm like a bad penny. You can't get rid of me. And my books are available on Amazon. So if you go to Amazon, you can check out my books that's out right now, and you'll find out about the books I've got coming out.
Brilliant. Well, I'll put links into everything for the show notes for everybody to track you down. And I just want to say thank you again, George. It's been lovely to finally speak with you, and I hope we get a chance to speak again in future.
My beautiful wife made me an incredible website. It's authorgeorgelunsford.x10host.com. And she puts everything in there. She's amazing. She's, you know, she's the brains. I just write the books. So, yeah, if you check out my website, everything will be on there, too. And thank you very much for having me. It's been a true honor, and I've enjoyed it.
Hey, you're very welcome. I'll make sure we focus that website, make sure we show your wife's talents off. And once again, thank you for joining me. It's been a real pleasure, George.
Thank you.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.